good.
I'm trying to think. It's JL51. The downlink transmitter is something like 30 watts or 20 watts. Actually, these guys use 5 watts, and it works just fine on the FM satellite. No way in heck you can do that on the linear satellite. By the way, the antenna setups that I have, my antennas are signally polarized. They switch from left hand to right hand. It was at the time, I think, the first antenna I built, the second antenna I bought. It's actually a cush graph. I don't think they make it anymore. I still have them. I just haven't put them up yet at this house. I've had them at the other house. The FM transponders, the FM satellites are very forgiving. You can work them with 5 watts. You gotta know where they are. You gotta realize that they move rather quickly. You only got like 6 or 8 minutes. Sometimes more, depends upon how much horizon you can see. You don't need a heck of a lot of gain, but the more the merrier.
In the early days of the satellites, the majority of them were transmitting linear polarization, and as the satellite rotated, if you were using a linear antenna, you got some pretty severe QSB wow effects. Are the modern satellites still using linear, or some of them using circular? Over to you, Eric.
I believe there are 2 Japanese satellites that are actually the stable antenna platform. The body of the craft rotates, but that depends. They tried making one which actually tried to keep a linear plane pointed towards the Earth, but the magnetotalkers really didn't work out as well as they wanted to. So, you know you're going to get some rotation, and you have to deal with it. The other bad thing about having 2 separate radios is you got to, as the satellite moves away from you or towards you, you got to twist both knobs in opposite directions from one another. Not true with the FMs. The FMs are actually constant out. So, you know, they're both, the Doppler goes the same direction with both input and output. But with the linear stuff, no. It's a different world.
The words you gave us on that transmission, Eric, with the linear platform rotation, whatever, leads me to believe that an awful lot of the satellites today are linear polarized, not circular polarized. I know that when it comes to the upper UHF region, in the old days, some of them were using a quadrophile helix, which was transmitting a purely circular polarized signal. But are none of the VHF, UHF satellites transmitting CP? Is that what you're saying, Eric? Over to you, Eric.
Again, it depends upon, you know, who made them. You know, the AMSAT one for years, they were all circularly polarized. Some of them have rotation, which was, you know, it's actually a dipole, but the way the satellite switched, you wind up with a rotating wavefront. I don't know if there's... I know AMSAT is working on a new one. I'm not quite sure what the antenna system is, so... I mean, we can look that up. That's easy enough. But I'm not sure what they're doing today. I haven't been active in, I guess about 5 years, 6 years, because I haven't had an antenna system to work with.
So, Bob, I do recommend you try to find out what is the polarization characteristics, uplink and downlink, of the satellite you're about to use. If it's a linear polarized satellite that is rotating in order to give itself a non-coordinate stability, as they call it, in other words, a point at one point in space all the time, it goes into linear polar, it goes into rotation like a gyroscope, and if your satellite is using linear polarization and you on the ground are using linear polarization, your signal is going to go up and down in amplitude quite severely. And in that case, you'd like to use circular polarization on your antenna to compensate. However, if the satellite is using circular polarization, you don't have that problem, but now you have another potential advantage. If it is a circular polarized satellite, and you use a linear polarized antenna, you'll talk to it beautifully, but you'll be at a 3 decibel disadvantage. If it's a clockwise circular satellite, and you're using a clockwise circular antenna, you'll restore that extra 3 dB of gain on the exact same length of boom. So you want to find out the polarization characteristics of the satellite you're about to work through. Also, the ERP requirements. Some of the linear satellites in the old days. Let me drop.
By the way, you can go to amsat.org. It's all listed there.
And when he goes to AMSAT, he's going to find out that particular satellite he's about to use has these characteristics. In the old days, the linear polarized satellites, well, linear satellites, meaning sideband capability, needed something in the vicinity of 100 watts of uplink EIRP to work well. That might be 10 watts of output with a 10 dB gain antenna, or a near the isotropic antenna, something very simple that doesn't require aiming, and a 100 watt transmitter. So the uplink used to need 100 watts of ERP. Has that changed very much, do you believe, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW?
As far as linear transponders go, no, that really hasn't changed. As far as FM satellites go, you don't need that much of. You know, we strive for, you know, one-tenth of a microvolt in an FM receiver. Once you've got capture, you're there. With the linear transponders, that's a whole nother story, because you're actually creating, the uplink signal becomes an IF, that in turn gets amplified, you know, it gets hit by another oscillator and gets amplified and stepped back out. One thing I will say about satellites when you're least expect it, sometimes they tumble, meaning that you get this Faraday fading as the antenna points away from the Earth and then comes back towards the Earth. That's something that you will experience. You don't notice it really on the FM satellites because unless there's completely no signal headed back down towards Earth, then you'll get noise. But because of the limited IF and the capture ratio of most FM receivers, you sometimes don't notice that at all.
So as you can see, Bob, you're going to be doing a little bit more research as to which satellites are available to you, what are the requirements for uplink and downlink, and what antennas and powers you're going to have to use, and in the case of a linear satellite, sideband capability, you got to worry about not overloading the uplink, otherwise you'll make yourself very unpopular very fast. And in those cases, you're going to want to listen to the downlink, full duplex operation. The majority of guys that are running a mode 2 satellite, in other words, UHF up, VHF down, put the two separate antennas side by side, let me pick a number, 3 or 4 feet apart on some kind of a aiming arrangement on a tripod. They do it that way because they don't understand that with proper filtering, so to make sure that your transmitter on one frequency doesn't overload the receiver on the other frequency. Let me drop. If they understood enough antenna theory, they would know that those two booms could be strapped together, and the thing could work beautifully. But the average guy doing satellite work mounts the two antennas side by side, a couple of feet apart, horizontally displaced, because they want the antennas to be thoroughly separate. They don't have to, but it makes them feel more comfortable. So as you research this further, and there's a lot of questions you're going to want to ask and get answered, please come back and tell us what you find. And I wish there was a group, maybe the computer group, who will give you more information about satellite work. At least I am very light on satellite work, although some of the people who sign into this TechNet have quite a bit of satellite experience. Particularly Barry, N2MB, although he's on vacation right now, he's one of the guys you want to talk to. He's got a lot of satellite experience. And there's about two or three other guys on this repeater. KA2GEF, K2RIW, go ahead, Bob.
Okay, okay. I appreciate all the information, and yes, I will dig around and get the information from AMSAT about the things I need. I'll probably end up staying to start off with just the FM satellites. And I have two rigs, and use them. I'll try it. And I'll get back to you guys and let you know. Eric, thank you very much for the information. And Dick, thank you again. KA2GEF will be sticking his nose in a book from now on. Thank you very much, guys. Good night.
WHYY with a question on this subject. You've got a joke. Doesn't one need some sort of a man of RF filtering to prevent the transmit noise from one band affecting the other radio and the other band? Or is it not necessary?
Depends upon the front end of the radio.
We already said that a good amount of filtering is usually required. When you buy a radio that's made for satellite service, that filter is already built in. But if you and I are using two separate transmitters and receivers, you better have a damn good filter. Because those two antennas, even if they're on a separate fiberglass boom, they're only a foot or two apart. And because the average receiver has got 120 dB of gain between the antenna and the loudspeaker, unless you've got some damn good filtering, you're going to be getting overload from one transmitter to the other receiver. Over to you, Joe, KQRIW. So what are the radios that are made for? What do they actually have inside them? Like a passband filter for high band and another passband filter for UHF? That's a big 10-4, good buddy. Okay, that answers that. Over to the next guy. Now we're going to go to Bob number 2, Kilo Delta 2, November Victor Bravo, K2LIW. You got it, Bob. My name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. Hi, everybody. This is Bob, K2NDB, and I was on last week, and you might remember I was asking, I'm getting a new radio, my first radio beyond an HT, and I was asking last week about 2 meter 440 antennas. This week, as about a month ago, I'm going to go back to HF antennas, but an aspect here I don't think we touched on last month, I've been looking at loops. I just wanted maybe to get Derek, your opinion, and anybody else's opinion. I've been reading a lot of EHAM reviews and other stuff on the internet, but particularly looking at these MFJ loops, and for starters, I know about the MFJ's reputation with QC, so I know that's a caveat from the beginning. Two sub-questions, because one is a receive antenna that was reviewed in this month, meaning April issue of QST. Some of you guys may have read this. About the receive loop, the MSJMA's brand new product, I believe, the, what's it called, the 1886, if I got that number right. Yes. And that is supposed to receive every band from like, what is it, half a megahertz up to, you know, all the way through 10 meters, I believe, maybe it's a little more. And that's very appealing. I'm the guy with the, you know, one of the guys, I should say, in a very limited situation. I'm talking about an antenna in my service department. I just don't feel comfortable in my situation to even try to stick them out the window or maybe get in the window on the inside, just next to the window. So, anyway, asking for opinions on that 1886 receive only loop, and also I was looking at the transceiver, you know, transmit and receive loops, the 1788 that does 40 through 15 meters. You know, a lot of people have good reviews on that for someone like myself who's in a very limited environment. So I just wanted to throw that out there and see what people's opinions about maybe loops in general, if they have specific about those products. But, that's okay. I'll put it out there. Okay, Dick, thanks. Over to you.
I generally have good news for you, Bob, number 2. You asked this question on 20 meters on Saturday afternoon. You're going to get a whole lot of crazy pieces of information. Let me show you the source of one of the crazy pieces of information. If, for instance, you're operating on the 80-meter ham band, 3.7 megahertz, for instance, a full-size dipole is roughly 132 feet long, made out of 14-gauge wire. That's a big piece of antenna that requires at least a half acre of a property to put it on, so to speak. If you used a loop antenna made for 3.7 megahertz, that loop antenna could be a couple couple of feet in diameter, and if it's made out of low-loss materials, and if it's a good design, it can have the exact same performance as that 132 feet of wire if I put the two antennas at the same altitude. I mean, if the dipole is up at 100 feet and the loop antenna is in your apartment in the third floor, which is 40 feet off the ground, there's going to be a difference in the amount of signal strength getting to the antenna because of altitude. But once you cancel that out, the dipole and the loop can have the exact same performance. Lots of people will say, hey, the loop is so small, it's got to have a smaller effective capture area. Good sounding common sense, dead wrong. Let me drop. Obvious, to many people, the Bible of early antenna books that are highly respected is the John Krause book called Antennas, McGraw-Hill, 1950. A very respected book, used as a college master's level textbook for antenna design. In there, he talks about the infinitesimal dipole. You can make a dipole, instead of 132 feet long at 80 meters, you can make it 32 feet long. And you can force it to operate on that frequency by having a very wide range antenna tuner, putting the right kind of a tuning network on it, putting a helical winding and top head capacitors and zigzagging and loading coils. There's various ways you can force a very small dipole to be resonant. Once you do, if it's made out of low-loss material, it'll give you the exact same performance as the full-size dipole. Opposite of common sense. The average ham will tell you, if I cut down the size by 2 to 1, I've cut down the area by 4 to 1, it'll have 4 times less effective capture area, and therefore it's going to give you a lot less signal. Absolutely wrong. The only thing wrong with the compact antennas, whether it be an infinitesimal dipole or a small loop antenna, is they make up the extra effective capture area by a high Q resonant circuit. That's a fancy way of saying it's going to be narrowband. If you QSY 50KC, you're going to have to retune either the antenna or the impedance matching network that's connected to the antenna. That's a slight disadvantage. But loop antennas made out of the right materials can give you full performance. Let me drop.
C2IS, query.
Okay, be with you in a minute. The loop antenna in the apartment is very easy to aim in order to peak up the right signal strength in that particular direction. And if you're going to put 100 watts into it, make sure there's a couple of feet between you and that antenna. Don't put your head in the middle of the loop and operate 100 watts. You will create a radio frequency biohazard. Your next question is going to be, how close can I be to the antenna and be safe? And something greater than 5 feet, in most cases, is going to make you safe. If you're running a key down 1,500 watts, I'd make that distance a little bit more. However, very few people will run a loop antenna with that kind of power for a whole bunch of complicated reasons. AC2IS, K2IW, go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Dick, would there be any problem with using the loop antenna, as you described it, in place of an NVIS, quote-unquote sky burner, that would be directing its RF antenna energy straight up? AC2IS.
Okay. If you lay the loop parallel to the ground, the plane of the loop parallel to the ground, you will have almost the identical polarization characteristics of a horizontal dipole. A horizontal dipole that's, say, a quarter of a wavelength over the ground is a Nevis antenna. A loop antenna, a quarter wavelength over the ground, with the loop parallel to the ground, is another Nevis antenna. And if the loop antenna is made out of the right materials that give you high performance, and you can tell that right away by putting a 50 watts into it, key down for 3 minutes, turn off the transmitter, walk over there, and touch everything. If the antenna is ice cold, it's running at 100% efficiency. That's a very sensitive test. So you get the exact same efficiency and performance out of a loop and a dipole. And so will it be a Nevis antenna? Absolutely. The next question is going to be, if I've got the loop perpendicular to the ground, am I still a Nevis antenna? Well, in that case, you're primarily vertically polarized in the direction you're transmitting. and with vertical polarization, I believe Nevis does not work as well. AC2IS, K2RIW.
K2IS, so you're saying that if the plane of the loop is horizontal, so that you're pointing the signal up into the air, I mean, you're also pointing the signal down as well. So I guess it's really the signal that's going up that's useful. But you're saying the polarization is not right and it's not likely to be useful. Is that correct? AC2IS.
If you're running a Nevis dipole, half your signal is going up, half the signal is going down. The signal that goes down bounces off the ground, comes back essentially in phase with the signal that's going up, and that's what makes it a Nevis antenna. So whether you launch the signal up and down simultaneously from a dipole or from a horizontally polarized loop, the signal doesn't know the difference. Over to you, Bill, K2LIW.
If you're doing this on top of a building, would you have to, or would you want to lay out some kind of an artificial ground plane? AC2IS.
On a frequency like 80 meters, I say it's not required. First of all, if you're going to locate a ground plane that's going to be effective, it's going to be 150 foot on a side chunk of aluminum screening. You ain't going to do that. At 3.7 megacycles, 98% of that building is transparent. That signal goes down through the building, hits the ground underneath the building, and bounces back up. That signal doesn't even know that your building is there, with the exception of the plumbing and wiring. And the plumbing and wiring, even that would be completely transparent unless a particular length of the wiring or a particular length of the plumbing just happened to be a resonant length, which is very rare. A building at 80 meters, for instance, is very transparent. Opposite of common sense. Over to you, Bill, K2LAW.
Okay, I think the answer on the polarization was that there is a polarization problem, correct? Other than that, I don't think I have any questions. AC2IS.
If you're comparing the performance of a horizontal low dipole for Nevis operation, and you want your loop to give you the same performance, you're going to lay the loop parallel to the ground at that exact same altitude. If you put the loop perpendicular to the ground, you're launching a primarily vertically polarized signal that will favor the horizon instead of favoring Nevis. And now your next question is going to be, what happens if you tilt it at a 45 degree angle? You'll have half of each. Over to you, Bill, K2IW.
Okay, so if I have the plane of this NVIS antenna parallel to the ground, I point it up, but I know that, say, the party that I'm trying to communicate with is due east of me. Is there something I can do to orient the gap of the circularly polarized antenna to produce any benefit? AC2IS.
A loop antenna is a circle. It is not circularly polarized. It is a linear antenna. You can only launch circular polarization when you've got two separate emitters displaced electronically by 90 degrees. Horizontal elements and vertical elements on a Yagi, for instance, fed 90 degrees out of phase, will give you circular polarization. Loop doesn't have that capability, can't do that. Now, your Nevis antenna, straight up and straight back down, has some very nice characteristics when it comes to very short range. If on 80 meters I want to talk to my buddy in New Jersey, then a Nevis antenna probably will help me do that, as long as I'm not choosing the time of the day where I'm getting a lot of D-layer absorption on 80 meters, which is at high noon, for instance. I'm not going to get to him because of D-layer absorption. And every band and the time of the day is going to have a certain skip zone. 80 meters to a signal aimed at the horizon, you might be able to get a ground wave signal to the guy in New Jersey if he's if it's at nighttime, and then there's going to be a skip where the next time the signal comes back down to Earth, so to speak, is going to be in Chicago. And if you want to talk to somebody halfway between New Jersey and Chicago in that skip zone, there is the possibility that a horizon-aimed antenna is going to skip over that guy, and the Nevis antenna is not going to get there. So there are certain ranges where, even with the 45-degree slant, you may not be able to get there from here. AC2IS, K2LIW.
Okay, but my understanding is, say with NVIS, if the people I want to talk to are somewhere between here and Montauk Point, that NVIS is going to do the trick. Is that correct? AC2IS.
You got it. AC2IS. A Nevis antenna is a very near-range antenna. From zero range out to, I don't know the exact number, but I'm going to pick a number. Maybe 100 miles. That's a Nevis antenna. Over to you.
Okay. And so the position of the gap in a loop antenna, when I'm pointing my loop antenna up, or even if I point it in any other direction, doesn't make any difference, does it? The gap is where the polarization sort of points towards. So again, yeah, I would think that would make a difference, and if I was trying to talk to somebody in Montauk, I'd probably want to point the gap away from Montauk. Is that correct, AC2IS?
You're now asking for the antenna pattern of a loop antenna, and you think that it radiates a stronger signal where the gap in the loop is. Good common sense, no. That loop, the circumference of that loop with the usual method of construction is something like a tenth of a wavelength in circumference. It's an extremely short antenna, wavelength-wise, compared to a dipole. As such, that whole damn loop has almost the identical current flowing through it. The signal coming off that loop is primarily a H-field signal coming out of the axis of the loop. In other words, if you put a pole down the hole, down the center of the loop, that's the majority of it, of the signal coming out of that loop. It has nearly constant current around that circumference because it is so short in wavelength. So your concept that it radiates across the gap, in the direction of the gap, as if it was a Yagi, good common sense, it does not do that. Over to you, Bill, K2LAW.
Okay, I don't think I was thinking in terms of signal strength, but in terms of polarization. If my circular, if my loop antenna, not circular, my loop antenna is not, the plane of the loop is not the same as, not perpendicular to the ground. It's not the same as the plane of the ground. If I tip it up as is normal, I think I would want to have the gap pointing up because that would give me vertical polarization. If I rotated that 90 degrees so that the loop antenna maintained the plane it was in, but the gap just, rotated along the edge of the loop antenna, I believe that then I would no longer have a vertically polarized signal, but now I would have a horizontally polarized signal. Is that correct? And again, using that same kind of logic, would I want to point the gap in a particular direction in order to get polarization the way I want when I'm in NVIS mode, AC2IS?
Okay. Let me give you some information and let you answer that question. The current flowing around the circumference of the loop is nearly constant. 6 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 12 o'clock on the loop. The exact same RF current is flowing. Therefore, where the gap is located, whether it be straight up, straight down, or a 3 o'clock or 9 o'clock position, does not matter. the loop with its very high constant current around its circumference launches a very strong H field through the axis of the loop. That H field then creates a signal, which if the loop is perpendicular to the ground, the signal that you're launching, the signal that gets out there to the horizon, is vertically polarized. If you lay the loop parallel to the ground, the signal is being radiated in all directions toward the horizon, horizontally polarized. Over to you, Bill, K2LAW.
The antenna is pointed upward and downward. You're saying that looks horizontally polarized. Okay. And if that's horizontally polarized, then everything that would be optimal. That would be exactly what I would be looking for. Is that correct, AC2IS?
Because Nevis is never quite as pure as you think, because there's all kinds of reflections going on or around the objects that are in your neighborhood, and the sky itself is never a pure reflector, the ground is not a pure reflector, do some experimenting. Because the loop is finite in size and it's not a zillion pounds, you can try aiming it in all kinds of directions and tilting it all kinds of directions. I recommend you do all of that. But it is my guess that if it's Nevis operation you want, it is my guess, and I'm not positive on this, that you get the best Nevis operation when the plane of the loop is parallel to the ground. You're simultaneously issuing a signal that's horizontally polarized in all azimuth directions toward the horizon, but if you're looking for Nevis operation, that guy you want to talk to in, say, New Jersey, that horizontally polarized ground wave ain't going to get there under most conditions. So that signal going to the horizon in that situation is not doing you much good most of the time, I believe. Over to you, Bill, K2LAW.
Right, most of the signal is going up, but it's horizontally polarized. So if somebody else in Montauk has a regular dipole and they've got it pointed so as to launch this signal kind of up and down the island, east and west rather, probably going to get good coupling there, although maybe not. I would think it would though. What do you say, AC2IS?
If your buddy in Montauk, which is somewhat dead east of you, has his dipole north-south, so that the broadside of the dipole is east-west, he's going to get the maximum signal from you. If he had his dipole east-west, so he maximizes the broadside north-south, he's not going to hear as much from you. However, by way of the Nevis bounce, he might still be getting some signal. Yeah, he might still be getting some signal. But he's going to get the strongest signal, in my opinion, if his dipole is north-south. And if both of you are running a Nevis loop antenna, and you're both laying the loop parallel to the ground, I think most of the time it's going to give you the strongest signal. I'm not absolutely positive on this one. Over to you, Bill, K2LAW.
I think I've exhausted my questions. Thanks very much.
Yeah, the main thing that Bob wants to know, Bob number two, is that can he build HF antennas that are compact, that fit into his apartment and give him high performance? Answer is yes, yes, yes. There's a zillion of them. The loops are some, the class of loops, whether it be a real circular loop or a triangular loop or a square loop, those are minor details of methods of construction, electrical. electronically, it makes almost no difference. But there's a whole lot of small antennas, which are narrow band in frequency response, but Isotron, I think, made an antenna that would tune 40, 20, 15, and 10 meters, depending on how you set its controls. And it was a loop-like antenna with very high efficiency and high performance. So buy or build the right kind of antennas inside the apartment. You'll be amazed what you can do, even though most of your buddies are going to predict disaster and they're being overly pessimistic. A person with the right attitude can do very well on this. Over to you, Bob. Drag your feet in case somebody wants to add something to this. KD2 NVP. NVP with a delay. K2RAW.
I thought that was enough of a delay. Yes, thanks, Dick. I was wondering if I could throw a couple little more questions in quickly. My situation now is I'm afraid if I put these loops, I'll say the transmitting loop for the moment, that might be the most critical. The phone is going to be real close to a large metal cabinet. And I don't know, is that a deal breaker? Is that going to have maybe depending on how I organize the null, but I'd like to be able to turn it in any direction I please. So that's the big question. Just because the way my apartment's set up, I'd be impossible to move this thing. I have to get rid of it, I think. It's got my records in it and music. I'm a musician. And the other question would be, if I got both that receive and that transmit loop, would they have to be not too close to each other? Of course, I'd be only using one at a time. So over to you, Dick, TD2NVD. Thanks.
If I plotted the amount of signal I reflect off of metallic object that's in my environment, the radar people call that radar cross-section. How much echo do you get? The amount of echo you get from a piece of metal is a function of how close it comes to being a half wavelength in one of its dimensions. If I'm on the 80-meter band, half wavelength is 132 feet. Is there a dimension of your file cabinet that is 132 feet long? If the answer is no, it is almost purely transparent. Your eye sees a great big chunk of metal. Until you get to the 450 megacycle ham band, that cabinet is not there. It's transparent. All the wiring of your house and the plumbing of your house on the 80-meter band is transparent. The gutters and the downspouts, they're all transparent. Until an object, the length of a pipe, the length of a wire or whatever, approaches a half wavelength, it is transparent. Stop worrying about all those things. And there was a second question you asked. I suddenly can't think of the subject. Over to you, Bob, K2LAW.
Yes, I was wondering if by chance I bought both that receive-only loop and the transceiving loop, would I worry about having them too close to each other? Because it would be the transmitting one could have damaged the receiving one. So, that was it. Over to you,
Kate. And the thing you care about most is the universal law of antennas called the law of reciprocity. However an antenna transmits, as long as it doesn't have active components in it, like an amplifier or a circulator, as long as it's a truly passive antenna, it has the exact same performance when you transmit or receive. Transmit mode or the receive mode, it's got the same gain, same pattern, same side lobe level, same front to back ratio, same standing wave ratio. Therefore, if you've got an antenna that you can transmit into, why in the world wouldn't you use it for receiving? Over to you, Bob, K2LAW.
Yes, thanks, Dick. The receiver can receive a whole lot more. Like, for one reason, it can go from the entire HF band. I think it's either half a megahertz. I can receive 160. The transmit I can only receive from 40 to 15. But at least I'd love to be able to just listen to all these other bands, even if I can't talk to them. I mean, I'm never going to be able to talk on 160, for example, in my apartment, I don't think, but I can at least listen to it. I love to listen. I do that more than I talk, actually. So that's the primary reason. Some people say having a receive antenna is a plus, even when you're transmitting. But anyway, the part I resumed the first one. Over to you.
The antenna that's called the receiving antenna would probably work beautifully well as a transmitter if you're running QRP, 5 watts. It's hard for me to believe that somebody can build a receiving antenna, loop antenna, that can have reasonably high efficiency and tune to all those frequencies that wouldn't tolerate 5 watts. When you want to run higher than that, yes, you're going to run a transmitting type loop antenna. And once you've got the transmitting antenna, at least on those frequencies where it'll transmit, you can certainly do some very good receiving. When it comes to the two loops, if you're going to run two loops, how close can they be? And the answer is almost as close as you like, particularly if they're at right angles to each other. If you tilt the receiving antenna to be at right angles to the transmitting antenna, when you're transmitting, you'll get very little coupling. And even if they're only a couple of feet apart, as long as your receiver is either disconnected or it's got some kind of front-end protection, the signal being picked up by the receiving antenna when you're transmitting is not going to give you very much grief, particularly if you've got some kind of a relay to disconnect the receiver when you're doing it. But with some testing, you might very well find that the total amount of signal getting to the receiving antenna when it's set up at right angles is so small that you don't have to do any of the above. So there's ways you can make all of that work. It sounds like a showstopper. When you finally find out enough information, it's probably going to be a minor detail, Bob. KD2NVB, K2LIW.
K2RW, this is KD2NVB. Yeah, actually, I'm just thinking right now. I have these two windows on either side of the metal, big metal cabinet. I thought I had one on each side. It actually has a metal cabinet between them, which maybe that's a plus. So if there was any interference to it, maybe that would help, at least reduce it. And so I could probably turn them at different angles as I please. So, okay. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but that sounds that sounds like it to me. So, I think for now that's all I have. If you want to move on. So, KD2RW, this is KD2NVB.
Yes, if it gives you peace of mind to run the two loops on opposite sides of that cabinet, go ahead and do it. But at most of the HF frequencies you're going to operate on, your eye sees that very strong steel, large metal cabinet, and it looks to your eye like an extreme opaque object. At most of those HF frequencies, that is not there. It's thoroughly transparent. Picture a wave coming off your antenna, where the wave on 80 meters is 132 feet wide. That's a half wavelength. The signal coming off the antenna, I'm jumping over some details here, but you could assume the wave is 132 feet wide. You can see that 98% of that wave is going to wrap around that cabinet and go right past it and not even see it. So at most of your HF frequencies, that cabinet is thoroughly transparent, as is almost everything else in your QTH. So go ahead and run these experiments. You'll be pleasantly surprised as to how well you're going to do with internal antennas. And so don't let people talk you out of it. Don't let people convince you that it's going to be terrible. It's not. A number of smart guys have done it and worked out very well. We've gone down the list of people who signed in. I think it's now time we go over to physics and science report by Dr. Roy, AC2GS. And Roy, let's see how your signal sounds tonight. Mine is a little bit noisy, as you can tell. AC2GS and science and physics report number 22, K2RIW. You got it, Roy.
Question. And WS2N, I just want to make one announcement before it got too late.
Go ahead with your announcement, Paul.
Yeah, it's a TV show that's going to be on actually tomorrow. And I know some people are going to go to bed or they have to go to school. So I figured let me make this announcement now instead of later. It's called One Strange Rock. It premieres on the National Geographic Channel. If you have Optimum, it's 162. National Geographic has this 10-part series and it's all going to be about the Earth, so one strange rock. It'll be on at 10 o'clock at night, and, you know, if you're interested in, you know, the Earth itself, the cosmic situation of where we are in the universe, the life cycle of Earth, human intelligence, anything to do with Earth, it's a story that's going to go from week to week, 10 weeks. Each week is going to be narrated by a different astronaut that has been into space. So it'll be, you know, from their point of view, what they see, what they think. It'll be, the actual main narration will be by Will Smith, the actor. So it looks pretty good. It's rated PGL. Let me drop it.
Is this going to be on PBS? Back to you, Paul.
The National Geographic Channel. So, I guess if it's on PBS, they might pick it up, sometime in the future. But for now, it's going to be National Geographic Channel Monday. So, tomorrow, 26th will be the first night. It comes on kind of late, 10 p.m., so you would have to record it. I'm suspecting because it's PG, maybe that's why. I don't understand what your rating was given PGL, but I'll find out tomorrow night. And anything by National Geographic is probably done very, very good. They've done quite a good job in the past. So try that and see how it is. Back to you, Dick.
Does anybody need any fill for the information that Paul just gave us? Give me your call letters right now.
Thanks for letting me do that. My brother gets National Geographic. He saw it advertised, and sure enough, I looked it up, and it looks pretty good. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that does sound like a goodie.
I'd like to believe
that that's going to be repeated on YouTube or whatever later on. You got a further question, Bob? KD2NVB, K2IW.
You may have just answered that. I don't have a television, and I was wondering if there's a way to watch it without television, so I guess wait for it to come to YouTube, or there's some other, maybe quicker way, if anyone knows. I'm just throwing that out real quick. Back to you.
You're one of the very few people I know that doesn't have a television. I know of a person who intentionally doesn't have a television because he thinks it's too much of a distraction, and he makes sure there isn't one in the house. And he insists on that for the whole family. So that's quite a story. N2XJN, Wes, do you have a question that on the subjects that we have just discussed? And is it a brief question? N2XJN, K2IW?
Yeah, N2XJN, which parameter of electromagnetic waves characterize horizontal or vertical polarization?
I heard some words about horizontal and vertical polarization. I don't know what the question is. Over to you, Wes.
Which parameter of electromagnetic waves characterize horizontal or vertical polarization?
Yeah, I didn't hear the word characterized before. The universal standard, an agreed upon agreement by all the antenna mavens, is that polarization is the polarization of the E field. If the E field is horizontal, it's a horizontally polarized signal. So the E field defines the polarization. Does that make some sense, Wes? Go ahead.
Perfectly correct. It's electric field vector. Thank you.
AC2GS, K2RIW. We're ready for science and physics report number 22. You've got it, Dr. Roy.
Thank you, Dick. Hello, Paul. Hello, everyone. How's my signal tonight?
Your signal is sounding very good. Please proceed.
Okay, I just want to do a little, the usual bookkeeping, although people don't avail themselves that much of it. I do have an email address. It is mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you have any questions or topics or you want any subjects explored, let me know. And if it makes sense to me and I'm able to do it, I'd be more than happy to do it. Tonight, I'm going to do a little tribute to the memory of Stephen Hawking. And then afterwards, take any questions related to the subject matter. Okay, this will be a short discourse on the life and times of the great scientist Stephen Hawking, but fear not, I will not use any mathematics. Stephen Hawking was not only able to stride the two difficult and distinctly different fields that are general relativity and quantum mechanics, but he was also adept at using the esoteric mathematics available to offer a mathematical foundation for these ideas. A great intellect has shuffled off this mortal coil on March 14th, 2018, the day of each year that we sometimes call Pi Day, Pi for 3.14, so March 14th, as well as the birthday of another pretty smart fellow, Albert Einstein. Stephen Hawking died at the age of 76. Not only did Stephen Hawking die on the 139th birthday of Albert Einstein, but he was also born on the 300th anniversary of the death of Galileo. Let me drop. Nothing spooky going on here. Coincidences like this happen more often than you might think. The law of probabilities is strange like that. Just because the probability isn't high doesn't necessarily mean unlikely things will not happen. By Stephen Hawking's death, he had become one of the most respected and honored theoretical physicists of his time. A fellow of the Royal Society, a lifetime member of the Pontifical Academy of Science, the recipient of the Presidential Medal of Honor, the Lucasian Professor of Mathematics at Cambridge, a post that Sir Isaac Newton himself held in his day. He was a popular author and made guest appearances on such diverse productions as Star Trek and The Simpsons. Surprisingly, he never got a Nobel Prize. The Nobel Prize is only awarded to theoreticians after those theories are proven with experimental evidence, and Stephen Hawking's theories have always been a bit difficult to prove experimentally. And since Nobel Prizes are not given posthumously, that well-deserved Nobel Prize will never happen for him. Let me drop. And yet, when Stephen Hawking was diagnosed with motor neuron disease, also known as amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease, when he was 21 years old and given an estimated life expectancy of 2 years and the probability of attaining all that lifetime accomplishment was a lot smaller than the events of his lifeline with famous people's births or deaths. Fortunately, Stephen Hawking's case of ALS was a very rare variant with unusually early onset and a much longer, slower progression of his symptoms. Anyone that saw Stephen Hawking knew that his ALS did progress, leaving him paralyzed in a motorized wheelchair requiring a voice synthesizer and increasingly clever control devices as his motor functions declined. In the end, his control systems relied on a single cheek muscle to operate. But Stephen Hawking did not have a clue that his ALS was a rare variant when he received his 2-year life sentence. I think if most people were given 2 years of life at the age of 21, they would have done a laundry list of things rather than taken an arduous doctoral program in theoretical physics. But it takes a very special person to choose to understand the universe, that they wanted to inform themselves before leaving very soon. And that was young man with Stephen Hawking, and that's what he chose. Let me drop. Many people that have seen and heard Stephen Hawking aren't actually aware that he's English. That's because he lost his own voice after a necessary tracheostomy, and a computer engineer fitted Hawking's wheelchair with an early voice synthesizer that had a decidedly American accent. Over the years, there have been many fine voice synthesizers with a selection of accents that were very English-sounding, but by then, Stephen Hawking decided that the public was used to him using that voice, and he kept it for the rest of his life. Stephen Hawking performed pioneering work on the concepts of singularity. He suggested that the Big Bang might be thought of as a black hole in reverse. He co-wrote a classic paper with Roger Penrose, The Singularity of Gravitational Collapse in Cosmology, suggesting that the Big Bang was itself a singularity. He wrote articles that suggested that quantum fluctuations during the early inflationary phase of the Big Bang were the cause for the very small inhomogeneities of the early universe that allowed local gravitational forces to condense into stars, galaxies, and galactic clusters. It is the same very small inhomogeneity that's seen in the remaining cosmic microwave background to this very day. Let me drop. Another concept that Stephen Hawking explored were primordial black holes. These were theoretically black holes that formed during the phase of the Big Bang, when there was a great deal of high-density inhomogeneity. These black holes did not form from the gravitational collapse of dying stars and didn't need to possess the mass restraints for such objects. Such black holes could theoretically exist at any mass, all the way from 10 to the minus 8 kilograms, all the way to thousands of solar masses. Black holes smaller than 10 to the 11th kilograms would have evaporated by now due to Hawking's radiation. These primordial black holes have been suggested as the possible source for dark matter, as well as the seeds for the supermassive black holes that seem to exist at the center of many galaxies. Let me drop. Stephen Hawking proposed the no-boundary proposal wave function. He proposed a wave function theory for the entire universe. Hawking attempted to describe the universe using a wave function, just as Schrödinger had derived the wave function equation for a single hydrogen atom many years earlier. During Hawking's work on the theory of quantum gravity in a paper with Jim Hartle, he theorized that at the very beginning of the Big Bang, space-time itself was squeezed into a state in which it acted more like space than like our conception of time, eventually resulting in a space-time with space-like space and time-like time. Time existed as an imaginary component, in his paper, of space-time that had no specific starting point. This proposal for the Big Bang is often seen in a graphic that looks a lot like a shuttlecock used to play badminton. According to the no-boundary proposal, the universe had no temporal beginning in Hartle-Hawking's steady state. How can you get from space-like time to time-like time without going to some length of time-like time itself? I have no clue. Let me drop. Roger Penrose appears to stack these shuttlecocks one on top of the other in his own pet theory for the Big Bang. How do you stack things in time that have no portions that are believed to exist in time? Roger Penrose suggested that time doesn't cease to exist, but rather loses its scale. Events can still happen before or after other events. You just lose the scaling intervals to define them, the seconds, the minutes, the years, etc. If you think about all this too long, I bet you'll give yourself a headache, so don't. If you are interested in pursuing just a few of the many available models of Big Bangs that are available, I set up a little alias, a website. You go to bang.ac2gs.com, and it'll take you to some excellent YouTubes that have interesting discussions by the theorists who explored the ideas to begin with. Let me drop. Stephen Hawking wrote a paper suggesting that black holes were objects that always increased in size and never could decrease. He jokingly referred to this as his second law of black hole thermodynamics. The joke was that black holes were a lot like entropy, something that must always increase, as the second law of thermodynamics states. At the time, Stephen Hawking was simply using entropy as a metaphor. He didn't think that black holes held entropy, because entropy suggests that black holes have something like temperature and something like black body radiation. Now, the guy Jacob Bekenstein felt that it wasn't just a useful metaphor. Bekenstein thought that black holes were really big bags of entropy, complete with something very much like temperature and very much like black body radiation. Now, Stephen Hawking at first tried to refute this. He thought it was his metaphor gone wild. But in the end, he actually concluded that the black holes don't always grow larger. They emit radiation, now coined Hawking's radiation, over eons. Black holes can be thought of as actually evaporating. So instead of spending time trying to